Welcome to Brains, a podcast exploring the inner workings of our brains, mental health, and disabilities, and how film and television portray them. Hosted by me, writer-director Heather Taylor.
And by me, film and television editor Sarah Taylor. Before we begin, we want to acknowledge that the lands from which we recorded this podcast and from where you are listening are part of territories that have long served as a gathering place for diverse Indigenous peoples. And we are thankful, as guests on this land, to be able to live, work, and gather here together. We continue to learn about the history that came before us and encourage you to do the same.
In our penultimate episode of our second season, we're looking at the experiences and representation of traumatic brain injuries, or TBIs, with our guest, Naomi Miller. Naomi is an equine veterinarian and podcaster who not only runs a podcast production company, but also founded the amazing International Women's Podcast Awards.
We discuss how a TBI can impact you with symptoms like headaches, neuroexhaustion, double vision, depth perception issues, sensory stimulation overload, and how Naomi spent 23 hours a day in bed after her accident.
Lastly, we talk about the representation of TBIs in film and TV and how Naomi would love to see more stories about the subtlety and variety of the effects of TBIs and what the long-term impact is on your brain, body, and mental health.
Quick reminder to our listeners that this interview should not be taken as medical advice and it is for informational purposes only. Because everyone's brain is different, please consult your healthcare professional if you have any questions. And now, Naomi. Naomi, welcome to Brains. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to meet you. And I've also just loved the conversation that Sarah and I were just having off air as well about podcast recommendations, which was so good.
Podcasters give podcast advice all the time. And this is what we're here for.
To start things off, I'd love for you to just tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
My name's Naomi, and as you may be able to tell from listening to me, I am based in the UK, so I live just outside London, and I am qualified as a veterinarian. So I had been an equine or horse vet for 15, 16 years, alongside running a podcast production company for the last 5 years. I started a podcast on a bit of a whim about 6 years ago. And I taught myself everything, like so many people out there. And then I was asked to start producing podcasts for a few other people. And that kind of grew and grew and grew. So I've been balancing working in podcasting, on podcasts, doing bits and pieces, helping out other people. I run a community of women and people of diverse genders in podcasting. And I also founded the International Women's Podcast Awards 3 years ago. So I do all of that. And then I do some veterinary work as well up until earlier this year when I had a traumatic brain injury. And at the moment, I am focused on podcasting until I am allowed to start driving and to start getting back to life as normal, which will hopefully happen soon.
So what causes traumatic brain injury and what does that look like for you specifically?
So it's very variable. And I think that was the thing that I learned the most from the medical professionals that I saw being in the hospital, being in and around the neuro trauma unit of the hospital I was in. I've subsequently heard a lot of stories. I'm sure you guys both do on this podcast as well. I've subsequently heard a lot of stories from different people about, oh, I had a concussive brain injury. I had a traumatic brain injury. I know someone who did, and it happened because X happened. And I haven't yet heard the same story being repeated twice, if I'm honest. Mine, I was in quite a significant car accident, and car accididents do crop up 100%. I was stationary in my car and somebody drove into me at high speed, unfortunately. I mean, I'm not nervous to talk about it at all. I was cut out of the car and I lost 10 days of my memory, so I have no recollection of anything. And I was very lucky that I happened to be driving near Cambridge in the UK. And for anybody out there who isn't aware, although I'm sure everybody is, Cambridge University is a bit like Harvard. And if you end up in the hospital there, it's full of international specialists, which was pretty good. So that's where I was taken. And I was very fortunate to have some extremely good medical teams looking after me through the lovely national health system that we have in the UK. And I'm making a full recovery, which was unexpected at the time, I think it's fair to say. So I feel very lucky.
Wow.
You said you've lost 10 days of memory, but have other people talked to you about that time, or were you unconscious during that time? Like, how did that kind of play out after you had had your injury?
Yeah, so I was unconscious to start with. So initially, my understanding of what happened to me is entirely from snippets and conversations and things that the emergency services have told me. My husband didn't arrive till quite significantly later on because he was working away, and some friends and family and people kind of given me snippets from the first day. But everything mm-hmm. I know is what other people have told me. So yeah, I was unconscious and initially in an induced coma to begin with. And they tried to bring me around from that on the first evening after the accident, and they couldn't. But I actually brought myself around later on, and I remained in the intensive care unit to start with. But the funny thing, or not funny, but it's not funny at all, but the interesting thing is that once I came around from being unconscious, I was awake, I was talking, I was having conversations with people, but I don't have any memory until 8 days later. And so the thing that scares me a little bit is I was making phone calls to people, and I was having conversations with people, and I was chatting away to people that came to visit me, and I had very restricted visitors in the hospital, but I don't remember any of this now. And my husband actually told me that a certain friend of mine had been to visit. And I was like, I haven't seen her. And he said, she came to the hospital. And I was like, no, she didn't. Yes, she did. And I just can't. And he said, you were chatting about blah, 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 and was able to tell me some of the contents of our conversation. Hmm. I have nothing.
How have you reconciled that in your mind? Like, knowing that you've lost those days, is that something that you've been able to, I guess, process?
I view that as quite a positive, actually, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
And mostly that I have no recollection at all of the accident or the aftermath, or in fact, the run-up. Mm-hmm. I have nothing from that day or the day before. And I think not having any recollection of the run-up in particular and then the subsequent events is probably quite useful from a trauma, however you would view it, perspective.
Yeah.
I feel very fortunate that those memories don't hang with me. And then I feel that for me, the worst of that first week was for my family. And that's the people that when I think about it, that's the people that I feel have suffered more than I have at that stage. I've had some problems since, and that's fine, but it was definitely, I feel that it was more difficult for them than it was for me, who was just, you know, sleeping all the time and can't remember anything. So I just was having constant naps in my bed, and that was that, really. So
what is the impact afterwards? Again, traumatic brain injury can happen a million different ways. Can have different impacts. So how has it impacted you, your life after that day?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I think you're right, Heather, that definitely it's very different for different people. And the one thing that I consider myself extremely lucky not to have suffered from, given other people I've spoken to, is significant headaches. And I think a lot of people who have post-concussive syndrome or post-concussive injury, the headaches and the light aversion can be really debilitating. And for me, it manifested once I was in the hospital for a couple of weeks, and once I came home, extreme tiredness, and neuroexhaustion is definitely a real thing that we can talk about a little bit. But that just walking down the stairs would mean I had to go for a nap. You know, and I'm quite fortunate. I play sports, and I'm quite a fit person. I run quite a lot. And that was just such a big change for me, because normally I'm quite an energetic person. I sleep well at night and I go to bed early, but I never need to nap during the day. And I just spent, 23 hours a day in bed to start with. And I would get up to eat, and that was pretty much it. So that was a big thing at the beginning. And then the other big manifestation for me was of the effects on my vision. I couldn't see. And I had multiple vision all the time in the first few months. And that was a big change. I mean, you can see, anyone who's looking at the video of this will see that I wear glasses, and I've had short sight for, donkey's years. I've worn glasses since I was 11 or whatever. So you know, I'm used to not being able to see super well, but I'm not used to seeing, you know, four of my dog or whatever. And actually that is quite tiring from morning to night when you see everything in multiple. And I think the other thing that rolls along with that was kind of depth perception, speed perception, things like crossing the road. I would have been a person who would have been like, okay, so that car's coming. I've got time to nip between, especially in London, like you just kind of nip between the traffic and, you know, cross the road like a crazy person. And now I am the person who I'm like, right, there's nothing coming from the left and there is nothing coming from the right. And I've got enough time to cross the road, because actually what's difficult to judge is, or was difficult to judge, it's got better now, but how quickly things were coming towards you and therefore how much time you had to make the crossing, for example. Another good example is just taking the underground in London.
Yeah.
You've got escalators, nightmare. You've got busy platforms. You've got busy trains. The doors open automatically quite quickly. Everybody piles on and off. Then you're looking down and I'm thinking, okay, so how big is the step? Is there a step down? How big, you know, how quickly do I need to go? What can I hold on to? My balance isn't great. I can't really see that well. I'm a bit unsteady. I'm so uncoordinated these days. Well, I was. And, you know, just putting all of that together makes one simple trip on the metro, which I would have done, you know, hundreds of thousands of times before, taking the tube becomes a big deal. And it's like, is there a lift? Is there someone to help me? Can I hold on to someone's arm? Are the doors going to shut on me? Oh my God, it's leaving really quickly. You know, like, yeah. It's a thing all of a sudden. Heather, I know Sarah mentioned you lived in London, so you'll know all about what I'm talking about. But yeah, nightmare.
Oh, I do. There was a really great app for a long time, and it doesn't work anymore, but it would tell you what car to get onto so that you can make the quickest journey. And it was so amazing. It was the thing that saved, because it's so difficult. And there's sometimes some of the stations, as anyone who's been to London would know, it feels like a 20-minute walk like inside.
Yeah,
You're like, I'm just inside. I'm like, I don't know where I am. I'm in some tube somewhere in a tunnel. But it was one of the most amazing things. And I feel like without it, it's pretty chaotic, even if you've lived there for a long time. So,
yeah.
Well, the other thing I realized was then how far you had to walk within a big train station. So just using King's Cross as an example, which is one of the big train stations in London, I would have never thought twice about coming from the train to the tube. But actually, that might be, I don't even know how far that is to walk, but to get to some of the tube platforms when you're a person who A, can't see that well, B, feels very tired, and C, doesn't have legs that work particularly well, that becomes really exhausting. And I think the thing that happened to me in the aftermath was I definitely gained an appreciation for people who don't find life that easy, but you can't see it. And everybody is in so much of a rush all the time that nobody looks. And now I find myself looking around being like, does anybody need a hand? Can I give this seat, this spot, this handle, this anything to somebody else? Whereas I probably didn't have that awareness before, if I'm totally honest.
In your experience, do you know of any films or TV series that get the experience of having a TBI right?
I have thought about this quite a lot since you sent me the original email when we were discussing this. And the answer is no. And I think, I mean, I'm not a great TV watcher, if I'm honest, anyway. But I think the one thing that has always frustrated me a little bit is I've always suspected that kind of, you know, cough and open your eyes, oh, they've arrived back in the world, is probably not true.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, in my experience, it was 100% definitely not true. mostly because I don't really remember. I don't remember at all any of that. I had a couple of small bleeds on my brain, and I don't have any reference points in film or television of anything discussing having a traumatic brain injury in the way that I did. I suspect it probably wouldn't make like a super engaging plotline. but I watched a lot of Grey's Anatomy when I was younger. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you watch medical dramas, A, they can't cover everything. And, yes, you know, I was fortunate I didn't have to have surgery, but having read some books and watched some documentaries written by quite a well-known neurosurgeon over here. I don't know that I've seen anything fictional that portrays quite accurately the trauma to, and the effect that a significant brain injury has on those around you, and B, the subtlety and variety of effects that it can have on the patient as well. Because I think we tend to think of, you have a massive brain bleed and you have an emergency craniotomy where they take out part of your skull to release pressure and it's all highly dramatic and et cetera, et cetera. But I do know several people who've had more, I guess you would say, less significant from an external perspective brain injuries. They don't look as dramatic, but those have had really big impacts on people's lives for really quite long times. And because they're insidious and long-term and reasonably difficult to judge from somebody from the outside, I've never seen anything covered about chronic, less severe, but still equally meaningful and significant brain injuries.
I feel like it's often like the Grey's Anatomy is like, yeah, the surgery, and then they wake up and then it's like, story's over. They're alive. And yeah. Or even like while you were sleeping, like the movie from the 90s?
Oh my gosh, Sandra Bullock. I loved that film.
He forgot everything before the injury, but then everything's fine. You just forgot. Like, you just move on. So we're not seeing that recovery, which I think is a really major part of a traumatic brain injury.
You said that there is a lasting effect for people, but it may not be this traumatic moment of like, oh, they've had their brain opened. They, you know, just this kind of long ongoing effect. What were some of those things?
I think visual deficits and then headaches would be a big one, I think. From a friend of mine who actually works in podcasting as well, funny enough, in the States, she had a traumatic brain injury in a car accident earlier this year as well. And she has had those light issues with light. So I think light aversion I mentioned earlier is a big problem. And people having tolerance to sound, light, visual, and any kind of sensory stimulation is a really big deal. So we frequently talk about the effect of being in crowds or the effect of flashing lights, the effect of a lot of noise. The first time I tested myself from a sensory stimulation perspective, you're going to laugh at this, I went to see Barbie at the cinema.
I love it.
That's a lot of stimulus.
It was a lot of stimulus. But the film was just out, and it was, you know, that the time when Barbie and Oppenheimer were both out, and we took a pic and we went to see Barbie. And it was... yeah, it was a lot. It was a lot. Like the surround sound and the color and just everything was just felt bigger and louder and brighter and whoa. But actually when I needed to, I was sitting in a dark cinema, I could just close my eyes for a second and it was fine. And you know, I really enjoyed the film. I love Margot Robbie and it was good. And actually it was a good test because then I felt like, okay, I can do this. And I think that's the other thing when you are asking Heather about long-term effects, nobody is really able to tell you because everybody is so different as previously discussed. It's very hard for medical staff to tell you what your capabilities are going to be. Everything is a test of yourself, and everything is a bit trial and error.
I just recently finished reading Sarah Polley's memoir, Run Toward the Danger, and she has a whole chapter at the end about her because she had a TBI. And one of the doctors saying, you have to run towards the danger. Like, you have to do those experiments, like you said, with the Barbie movie, and test yourself and see what you can do. And it's like, feels like often the opposite of what we want to do, right? So how did you decide, okay, I'm going to go to the Barbie movie. I'm going to test myself with this major sensory overload. Like, what made you go down that path?
Well, I started testing myself with things quite quickly, mostly because I am self-employed as well. And so not working equals zero income. And I haven't got back to anything significant this year yet, but I was determined that I wanted to keep trying to do something every day. And partly because then your life has no structure. And I'm sure the two of you, you're busy women and you have a lot on in life. And it's when you suddenly go from 100 miles an hour, not that I really like going at 100 miles an hour, but you know what I mean? And suddenly you're going at zero and your life has lost all pattern, all structure. And you have nothing ahead of you on a day-to-day basis other than just get better, you need to rest, which is true, very true. And, you know, as I mentioned, I spent a lot of time sleeping, but actually having those little challenges. So today I'm going to walk to the end of the driveway. Tomorrow I might walk to the end of my road, which is 30 yards or whatever. And the weather was quite nice here in the UK when I came home. It was quite sunny, it was warm. And so each day there was an incentive to try something. And because of my vision and the double vision, I was wearing an eye patch constantly on one eye or the other because I could only view single things out of one eye or the other. And so I couldn't watch telly or look at a laptop or use a phone at all in the first few weeks, months, whatever. And then gradually over a period of time, that got better. But it would be, okay, I'll reply to one message. I will look at one email. I will watch 5 minutes of something. And then gradually it just started to build up. And then we were actually invited to go and see Barbie. And we just thought, I just said, what's the worst that can happen? If it's absolutely terrible, we'll walk out and we'll go home and we'll just drive back from the cinema. No biggie. It felt like a lot of the mini challenges, let's call them, that I set myself were things that could be easily remedied by going home if necessary, or that could end with a lie down if necessary. And so all of those things were quite carefully planned. And I think that was, Heather asked a question earlier about what was the impact on my life. Suddenly having to become queen of logistics was the biggest impact on my life, because I am lazy as on organization. And I'm the kind of person who hops in my car and I just go when I'm ready. And suddenly I was like, right, if I want to go to see my parents, I'm not allowed to drive. They live 3 hours away. So, okay, I need to be dropped off here, accompanied there. I need to book a ticket in advance for this. I need to find a train. I need to somehow get myself across London. I need somebody to come with me. Someone's going to need to help me with my bag. Someone needs to pick me up at the other end. Yada, 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 you know, and all those things just became more significant and still are to a degree, much less of a degree, but yeah.
And I can imagine how the people in your life close to you, of course, telling them that, but maybe people not as close to you understanding, like, well, you seem okay. Like, you should be, can you go do this? Or,
oh my gosh, Heather, if anybody said to me one more time, you don't look like you've been in a car accident, I was like,
oh my gosh.
If I had a pound for every time somebody told me that, I would be so rich. And I was like, yes, no, I don't, but trust me, I have.
Well, I was thinking about another film, just because we were talking about it at one point, but Concussion, I was curious if you ever saw that. It's different, obviously, not a car. It's to do with traumatic brain injury in terms of like continual concussion, but basically talking about a doctor looking for the truth to help the long-term effects of repeated concussions on football players.
Oh, yes. Okay. This is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. It was based on a real person. It's a true story of Dr., I think it's Bennett Omalu. It's a bit of a thriller, puts him in danger, but he's like, we need to talk about this because we're killing people with the sport. Curious, like, if any of the things resonate with you, or is it more like just the idea of, again, it's so quiet about this that everyone kind of, you know, it's something can happen and it's kind of put aside as if it doesn't have a long-term effect. It's just like as you were sleeping, when he wakes up and he's like, I don't remember, but this is my fiance. Okay, cool. I'll just marry her. I mean, that's really dodgy for many reasons, but
yes. Like,
it was the 90s, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, and I think that's really interesting. So Over here, we have the big conversations around CTE, which is the chronic traumatic encephalopathy that results. I think in the States, you have that with football. We see it. There's big discussions in rugby and then soccer through heading a ball all the time as well. And those conversations are ongoing. And I suppose I view my situation differently to that in the sense of I had one major blow to my head and I hopefully won't be taking any more subsequently. And I hadn't taken any before, not anything significant that anyone was aware of, let's put it that way. So I suppose I view what happened to me as one discrete incident as opposed to multiple repeated incidents over a period of time, which I think is what is seen in sports. But I think previous to this, I had never considered the impact for the long term on my brain of an injury such as this, because I never thought that something like this would happen to me. I, as I mentioned, I think at the top of the episode, have been a horse vet for 16 years and I spent a lot of time driving, and I worked out that I've driven somewhere between 250,000 miles at work, just for work, over the last 15 years.
Wow.
And I have been very, very lucky that I have a terrible carbon footprint, sorry world, but I also have not been involved in any serious or significant accidents. I've had a couple of little low-grade bumps, but nothing serious.
Yeah.
And I just didn't ever envisage that an incident such as this would have ever been a part of my life or have ever happened to me, because like everybody, I just go along in your tunnel and you just deal with what's in front of you. And I don't know, I've been a lucky person and a healthy person. And for that, I consider myself very, very lucky previously.
Yeah. And I think it's, what's interesting too, is that, we just don't see it a lot in media, unless you're looking for it. Like the idea that you said of the documentaries, and we had something, concussion being around something that's elite sports athletes, right? Those are elite athletes and they're putting themselves into this danger. I mean, there's two other films, but again, I haven't seen them, like The Lookout from 2007. That was a while ago. I don't even know this one, but it's like about someone who has a traumatic brain injury and he struggles to hold down a job, but, eventually finds a job as a night janitor in a bank. And then there's an attempted heist. I mean, of course, there's an attempted heist. And so he has to decide, what's right and wrong. And I was like, I don't know why that is. This is just me. But it's supposed to be a good representation. So I guess check it out. And another one called Patience, which is like a comedy drama, which is about a man recovering from a major sports injury that left him unable to take care of himself or partake in former hobbies. So when he lands at a physiotherapy center, he forms a group of friends and they learn basically that even after an accident, every life is about the same thing. So, and in this case, they say dating, laughter, fun, and friendship. So
That sounds wonderful. Well,
lovely.
That sounds really good. One thing I did look at quite a lot in the aftermath, because I couldn't watch anything or look at a screen, which was quite sad when I had all this time, I could have watched a lot of Netflix. I just thought, I've got so much time in bed ahead of me. This will be great. I'll watch loads of films and loads of series. No. But what I did have a lot of time to do was listen to stuff. And so I started looking for podcasts, obviously, because I'm a podcast obsessive. And I thought this will be a really good time to learn. And one thing I really discovered, and I think this was around the time that I probably started chatting to you guys, was there isn't much out there about traumatic brain injury. And there are a few long-going podcasts. There's quite a big one in the States. And one I discovered in the UK, which actually I have listened to, which is not specifically about brain injury, but is called The Recess Room, and is it's quite a scientific podcast, actually. So it's not for the faint-hearted listener if you don't like a bit of science, but it was it's very well done. And it's a doctor, a nurse, and an air ambulance paramedic who present it. So it's really scientific, really accurate, and really good, and they're great. And I found that a very useful resource, actually, of it's a British podcast, and so it had quite a lot of British resources attached to it. And yeah, I think that was the thing I was looking for that I didn't find. But to be brutally honest, I couldn't look at my phone very much, and so I didn't have the capacity to be doing deep dives into what was available for me to initially listen to and then watch. And by the time I got around to being better enough to be watching things of any significant length, I was, you know, back to watching Sex Education or whatever was new out on Netflix over here at the time.
And going to the Barbie movie, as you do.
Yeah, exactly. Having a change of genre. So
how do you deal with the neuro exhaustion, which you mentioned earlier? How do you deal with that in the recovery process?
I'm very fortunate, Heather and Zara, that I now do not have neuro exhaustion to any significant extent now. I feel that my tiredness and my energy has returned to what it was pre-accident. However, in the first instance, I mean, that the neuro exhaustion lasted 4 months and was super significant at the beginning. And the way I dealt with that, Heather, was to only allow myself to make one small plan per day initially. So to begin with, it would be, like I said before, I'm going to walk to the bottom of the stairs. And then even after that, if I had somebody coming to visit me, that was the day's plan. They might have been coming for a cup of tea for an hour or something, but that would then be the whole day. So there was one thing per day, which also gave some structure to me and gave me something to wake up for in the mornings, which was good. But I had such a lot of medical appointments, but each one was, that was the day's plan. It was, I'm going to see this person for a cup of tea. I have an appointment with the physio. I have to go to the neuro-ophthalmologist, whatever. And that would be, this is the diary entry for the whole day. Even if I know that that's only going to take 30 minutes and it's a 15-minute drive, that's the day's plan, because inevitably I will come back and I will just sleep, and that's okay. And just really giving myself the grace to say, you can go to bed at midday and that is totally fine. And yeah, I would often be awake for a few hours in the morning, and then that was that. And anything after 6 p.m. was complete write-off. And then gradually I started allowing myself to maybe do one thing in the morning and then one thing at home in the afternoon. So, okay, this afternoon I might have a phone call with somebody, or a lot of my friends rang, or people. I was very, very lucky that I have lovely, lovely friends and family. And I would say, can you call me on Tuesday afternoon at 2 o'clock? Because I know then that if I've done something in the morning, I will just want to talk to somebody so I'm not lonely, because that's the other factor, that when you're used to going out all the time, then that will be the afternoon's activity. One phone call with an old friend, that's my afternoon.
Just as a follow-up to that, you mentioned physiotherapy. What kind of physiotherapy did you end up doing?
I was very fortunate. So I'm going to say this because I am like a massive advocate for safe cars, but I was driving a Volvo. And if you live in Europe, everybody loves a Volvo for safety. They're considered to be, they used to be considered to be quite uncool these days. Very cool.
They're so cool
but
now.
Yeah, they're so cool now. And also extremely safe. Volvo, the first brand to introduce seatbelts. And to really promote them a long time ago. But yeah, I was very fortunate to be driving one of those, which was my luck at the end of the day. And I didn't have any other injuries apart from my brain injury. I've had some neck issues with my whiplash, but I didn't have any other serious injuries, let's put it that way. The hospital were bemused and surprised that I didn't have multiple fractures. But wow. I didn't. And yeah, I didn't walk because I was in a coma, but if I had not banged my head quite badly, then I think I would have walked away. So yes, I was very fortunate. But no, just going back to the physiotherapy, I love my neurophysio. She was sent to her at the beginning by a physiotherapist who I had seen previously for some just normal, what I would call normal musculoskeletal physiotherapy, just sporting related. And I rang her up when I came out of the hospital and she said, "Oh, you don't want to come and see me. I'm going to send you to a neurophysiotherapist." She was like, "You need to see someone specialist." And Libby, who is my neurophysiotherapist, is just the best. And she has been seeing me since I came out of hospital 5 months ago, and she's still seeing me, and she has pieced me back together along with multiple other specialists and paraprofessionals. But I love her to bits, and she has been incredible, really, really incredible. And I didn't know really what neurophysiotherapists did because I hadn't had any experience of them. But just talking to her, her caseload is A, very varied, and B, very different. And she helps a lot of different people with a lot of different neurological conditions. And she has been extremely good.
Can you give us, one example of an exercise or something that she would get you to do
as I've got better. So one of my remaining deficits up until reasonably recently has been oculomotor coordination. So it's the coordination between your brain, your eyes, and your limbs, essentially. Things like catching a ball would be a nightmare. Let's just use that as an example because it's quite an easy one. My eyes don't work. Well, didn't work amazingly well. So then you're seeing, you know, three balls when it's coming at you. And even if somebody threw you a very gentle, very simple ball, maybe a tennis ball that's nice and, you know, relatively soft, should be relatively easy to catch. By the time your wonky eyes have communicated with your brain and that communicates with your hands, bang, it's on the floor and you're clapping at thin air. And so It's just things like that, just learning how to do exercises, passing things from one hand to another, looking at things in certain directions, focusing your eyes in order to get your brain to compute where your hand is in space related to your eyes, related to the thing that you have in your hand would be an example. And then one of the other things I struggled with for a while was grip strength. So my hands couldn't quite coordinate that I needed to grip something. So I dropped a lot of stuff. Okay. Not even things that were thrown at me, but just things I picked up and then threw on the floor.
I just imagine like you're just dodging balls. You're playing dodgeball.
No, this would like, I'd pick a jar of jam out of the cupboard and drop it on the floor or that, you know, and, or I would go to take something off the stove and realize I couldn't lift a saucepan because I can't grip properly. Or I would go to pour the kettle to make a cup of coffee or a cup of tea or whatever, and I would just pour half the kettle of boiling water on the side of the kitchen instead of into a mug. And so just aiming things to live life was really quite difficult. And so just having exercises to practice all of those things together that didn't involve a kettle full of boiling water was quite useful. And
yes, very good.
You know, just making sure I didn't add to my list of problems. So yeah, just all those sorts of things, really.
You wouldn't think about that. Again, when we talk about what we see on TV and in film, you wouldn't think that, oh, you had a brain injury, you're going to have issues with grip. Like that just wouldn't connect, I don't think.
No.
Until we hear a story or we see it happened. And that is, that totally affects your life. I'm curious, how did having a TBI affect your mental health?
So with that, initially when I was first released from hospital, I was so physically unwell or not myself that the mental side of things didn't really come into play. To begin with, I was so conscious that I couldn't really see or walk or balance or, you know, get out of bed without falling over or whatever. Those things seemed to be the priority in the first few weeks and months. And actually, it was my husband who said to me, "I think there will come a time when you become frustrated that you can do things, but you're not allowed to, or that you think you should be able to do things, but you can't." And both of those things duly came into fruition. And the biggest thing for me, we live in a rural area so that we have to drive to the shops or I have to drive to go to the train station, for example. And not being allowed to drive has probably had the most practical significance impact on my life, just in terms of being constantly reliant on other people. And as somebody who values independence and freedom, along with adventure as part of my life values, that was quite difficult. But it's a learning curve, and you, like all things in life, you learn to make the best of the situation that you have and to cope with the position that you're in. And I'm very lucky. My family don't live close to me, neither do my husband's family, but we have people around us who are generous and kind. And my husband is a flipping rock. Like, he is mega. But it's been a transition to learn how to restructure my life to allow myself to do the things that I want to do in a practical sense, as much as everything else.
If you could now, with your experience, and you're like, you know, and obviously we've looked at lists of, it doesn't feel like there's a lot of representation, both across, let's say, podcasts as well as film and television, as we do podcasts. What would you like to hear/see?
I think I would love to see a representation of people whose lives have been irrevocably changed one way or another by a brain injury. And listening to a couple of your previous shows where people have talked about representation of mental illness and representation of other brain disorders, should we say, I think it's always about the story of people who've been in that situation or another to be shown. And it doesn't, I think for me, watching somebody who had an injury like mine and the subsequent aftermath of that, a lot of it would be pretty boring for the viewer, to be brutally honest. It's slow. It's quite like not much happens quite a lot of the time. It's the same as rehabilitation from anything, you know. It requires work, and it's hard work, and it's upsetting. And there are days when everything is so painful that you just want to cry all the time. And that's not entertainment necessarily in the way that somebody might want or expect. But I think that there is a place for other people to understand the effects that having a traumatic brain injury can have on a person's life. And even if that isn't the immediate consequences of the accident, or showing what that was like, you know, at the time, or showing a huge car crash and being in hospital and waking up and or whatever, maybe it's further down the line. But
yeah,
I think there's a space for those people, whether that's in a long running TV show as a repeated character or what, I'm not sure. But I think there's space for stories to be told.
Clearly, we need more. Are there any resources that you would suggest to other listeners who maybe have experienced this or have loved ones that have experienced it?
When I was in the hospital, one of the resources that I was given by the doctors in the hospital was from a charity called Headway, which is a brain injury charity here in the UK. And they have a lot of resources available for both traumatic brain injury sufferers, people who've had strokes, the families and friends of people who have had brain injuries. And everything is vetted and written really well, and it's all kind of scientifically backed up, and it's a lot of collaboration between the charity and hospitals and the charity and other professionals to really create resources for brain injury sufferers and their families and friends to bring it all together. And so Headway was a place that I was firstly recommended. A lot of the bumf we were given in the hospital, we were given printouts from the Headway website to read.
Nice. And
I know that my family took advantage of the resources that were offered there. And that is a place that I have gone back to subsequently as well.
Is there anything that we've missed? I mean, we could probably talk for hours about this, yes, but like in this short amount of time that we have on this earth together in this moment, is there anything that you'd like to mention that we may not have talked about?
I think my previous perception, and I guess this does come through films and TV over the years, was that people who suffered a traumatic brain injury always had a fractured skull or needed neurosurgery or, you know, had a piece of their brain or the piece of their skull removed or whatever. And I think I had never previously considered, probably because of the things we've discussed, that You don't tend to see very non-dramatic brain injuries represented in film and television. But I think I had never considered the impact of something that was a little bit, I mean, don't get me wrong, what happened to me was quite dramatic, but something kind of slightly less dramatic than half my skull missing that might happen to another person, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think you don't see what's not in front of you, do you? And everybody has their own thing in life, and there are lots of different medical conditions, and there are lots of people who suffer with various physical and mental ailments during their life, be that what they may. And people have personal interests in certain things because those have cropped up for them, their family, their friends, people close to them, whatever it may be. And I guess traumatic brain injury has unexpectedly and slightly unwantedly fallen into my lap. And that's where we are.
Well, where can people find you online and maybe plug your podcasts?
So, well, this is the other thing that was slightly awkward, was I was in the middle of a season of my own podcast, which then went out the window subsequently.
Yeah.
I've got recorded interviews that haven't gone out yet. So most of the podcasts I produce are for clients, and they're quite often quite niche. The one that I do myself is called Smashing the Ceiling, and that is interviews with women with unusual and interesting careers.
Love it.
So, yes. But the mainstay of what I work on these days is the International Women's Podcast Awards, which are happening quite soon. And if you want to see that online, we are at IW Podcast Awards on pretty much all platforms. So, yeah. And the social media platform on which I only ever really spend any time myself is LinkedIn. So if anyone's interested in connecting, then just find me there. Naomi Mella, you'll find me. I think I'm the only person on LinkedIn that describes themselves as a podcast producer and veterinarian. So it's kind of a unique skill set.
We'll find you.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to tell us your story and to share all things TBI with us. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. It's lovely to talk to you both.
So I was talking to my friend about this episode right after we did our interview, and she had told me her sister had a TBI, and I said, oh yeah, we couldn't figure out shows that were really great representation. And then she reminded me of the film Causeway. It has Jennifer Lawrence in it. I started watching it. It's about someone who has a TBI from an accident in Afghanistan when she was serving. And it, from what I was told, what we were told in this interview, it's spot on.
Oh, cool.
It's so good. She's also having trouble with PTSD as well, which would happen if you're in a major accident. But, well, you're exploded, basically. But it was done so subtly, and they didn't do the thing that often happens in films, that like throwing in the flashback, none of it. You just see her experiencing these things, and subtle things like she's on the bus and it turns and the light hits her eyes and she kind of like just kind of, you can see a reaction, but it's so subtle. I'm like, oh, this is the film.
Great.
And so I'm sorry that we didn't talk about this till this moment in time, but I had totally forgotten that it was in my mind, that film was more, I thought it was around PTSD, but the description of the film is like woman serving in Afghanistan has a TBI. I'm like, it's in the description, but in my mind. So yeah, I think a lot of things we're talking about films of the past, but such a great film to look at. And little subtle things like she's playing the memory game in her bed. Like she's supposed to continue doing all this stuff. And then, you know, having to deal with rehab when you don't have money and you live in a country that doesn't have healthcare that's provided to you, or and is trying to just also not admit that something's wrong because they're only, for them, their life was about serving. In the military, they're part of the Corps of Engineers and wanting to go back, and their specialty was water systems, and go back and do that work.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting to watch and like how you heal with a community and how you heal with people in your life that can help you. And not everyone in your life can help you, but to find those people who can be a support to you in some capacity. And I think that's really important for everything, whether it's a brain injury, it's mental health, it's disability, like everything, like there is people in your life that can be a support in some capacity. Even just being that person that listens is just so important. So Causeway is, I think, from what we were told, seems to be a very good reflection on what a TBI can be.
Cool. Well, what a great find. I'll have to go watch it.
It's been very good. I want to read the script now. So it's that good.
Wow. Do you do that often where you watch a film that you really like, you'll go out look for the script?
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, because I want to see how they wrote it because everyone contributes, but I like to see like how different people gave direction in their writing. Or like if you watch Haunting of Hill House, but you read the script, it's very different because good acting can erase bad writing.
100%. Yeah.
So it's like looking at something down to its bones to me is really interesting. Or like, I'm not saying Haunting Hill House is bad. I'm saying Haunting Hill House is scary. So if you take away the sound and that type of thing, I was like, oh, there's only three moments with ghosts in it in all of the pilot.
Yeah. But the whole time I was sitting there hiding under the blanket because it was so freaking scary.
Because you're waiting for it, right? Yes. It's anticipation, the dread. Like that's the whole point of that. That's the whole thing.
Yeah.
And so I really love to look at that. Or like, this is very old now, but 500 Days of Summer is told out of order. So like, how do they do that? How do they think about it? How do you look at emotion? Or like looking at transitions, how people do, like, how do you get out of scenes? And I think it's just, that's an important part of the craft.
Yeah, that's really smart. I like that. Insider writing room tips here from Heather Taylor.
It's interesting because like it happens to you work with a showrunner and there's quirks to their writing. And then you pick those up and say, that's a really great tool that goes in your writing. And then I sometimes often forget how to do intercuts, even though I do them all the time. Like it's when people like, oh, this person's on the phone and call someone and then intercuts.
Yeah.
And everyone structures them slightly differently. And then I'm like, how did that go again? And then I'm like, John August has a website and you Google things and it comes up anyways. And I'm like, there you go. I don't know why there's certain things that I like, my brain doesn't like, will not remember. I'm like, this is how you do it.
I do that. Okay. This is not the same, but kind of the same. What order does 5.1 audio go? When I get my audio mix for my sound person and I need to mix it into the edit, I have to make sure that my 5.1 tracks are in the right order and pan to the right direction. And every time I've done this like hundreds of times, I feel like, but every time I have to go and look up and make sure I do it, it's in the right order. So some things just don't stay stuck.
I know. It's really fascinating. I was reading someone's tweet the other day. And they're like, a lot of times she finds a difference in sometimes attitudes between different groups of people who she works with in terms of giving notes. She finds that the thing that we see in business as well, that often she'll find her male clients will be a little bit more like, well, I'm fine. And maybe this note isn't right. Whereas like she was giving someone notes who didn't really understand structure very well. And it's really just more formality, but the writing was good. And she's like, maybe I shouldn't write anymore. And you're like, no, that's not what I mean. Like, it's a very like polar opposite. But this idea of like, women won't apply for a job unless they have 100% of the qualifications, where this is statistically correct. Mm-hmm. And a lot of, not all, again, nothing is ever all because nothing is completely one or the other. But a lot of male applicants will apply with something they may only have half of the qualifications for because they have a belief in themselves, because you are encouraged to, but just try. Mm-hmm. You'll see that in certain groups of people, especially marginalized communities, you'll see that it's not only a belief of, it is often a necessity. So, but it does mean that they don't apply when they maybe could have gotten the job because they actually did have the right qualifications. They just weren't in the right guys, as it were. So everyone just apply for things.
Yes. I've had this exact conversation with my therapist about how I often attach my whole self to what I'm doing. And I think someone's hired me because of me as a human, and they're trying to explain or try to like, I'm sure some of it is about whether or not they like working with me, but most of it is because they've hired me for my skills. And that's the most important part, is that they hire me for a skill. Because if I didn't know how to edit, I wouldn't be getting the job, because I need to know how to edit to do the work. And having a certain personality or being whatever other non-skill things are a bonus, but that's not the only reason I'm being hired for something. And I think sometimes I get stuck on, I think it might be an anxiety thing. It could also be a gender thing, where I need to be well-liked and perfect in all ways in order to be accepted. And it's like a mindfuck to try to work it out.
Yeah. I think too, there's something when you are in creative roles, especially when you're in all creative roles, I'll say, but like when you're on the writing side, someone was talking to me the other day, we had a coffee and they're saying, I'm really bad at selling myself because I don't want to boil myself down to one thing. Because often we come in and you're like, well, I'm a this, 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 and this. Because we are actually, sadly, selling ourselves on who we are, but not who we are as a three-dimensional being. It's the stereotype that they believe in. So it's like, oh, I'm this. So then therefore they expect certain stories, but they don't, that isn't necessarily true. It's again, leaning into stereotype or leaning into, well, I want this one thing from this person without looking at all of the things they can provide. And so I can understand being like, well, I don't want to just be boiled down to one thing. Or I'll see things and I'm like, wow, I have so much experience about that. But does anyone know that? And that's hard too, because then sometimes you just don't know what a show's even about. And when you're going up for, let's say, for staffing or something like that. So sometimes we don't need to sweat the small stuff. And it is about figuring out who are the best people to work with, yes, but also like figuring out to that balance between like, I'm not just one thing, but like really showing here are all the, here's as many dimensions of me that I can show you in this time, including my skills.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a balance. I think being in the creative world is just, can be hard not to connect your whole value, because what we bring to the table is our values and our beliefs, and we put ourselves into the work we do. So it's hard to like sometimes unmesh yourself from what you create. Yes. But there has to be times that you need to know, like, this is my skill. I'm using my skill to do what I, whatever I intend to do with it for the show, but I can still be a whole human. This actually was a quote that I need to actually go back and listen to in Elliot Page's memoir. He says, I've come to the place in my career that I can be in a film that can be amazing or can bomb, and I'm still okay. And yeah, that is the thing that I want to achieve, is that I can be okay. I know I've done what I can do, and that's okay.
Yeah, agreed.
Let's all be okay. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of Brains. Brains is hosted and produced by Heather and Sarah Taylor, mixed and mastered by Tony Bao, and our theme song is by our little brother, Depish.
If you like what you hear, please rate and review us and tell your friends to tune in. You can reach us on all social platforms at Brains Podcast, spelled BRAAINS Podcast. You can also go to our website, brainspodcast.com, where you can contact us, subscribe, and find out a little more about who we are and what we do. Until next time, I'm your host, Heather.
And I'm your host, Sarah. Bye. Bye.